Hello and welcome to A Gay Old Time. My name is Nigel May. You may know me from things I've presented on the TV. You may know me as a host from my radio shows, or you may have read one of my novels. You may not know me at all, and that's just fine. But anyone who does know me will know that I am very proud to be a gay man and hugely proud to be part of a beautiful queer community. This podcast is a celebration of that community, of its many beautiful people, people of all ages, people who have fought with their emotions and who have faced struggles and emerged victorious, who have had to tread their own path in life to live their real truth. People who inspire, who aspire, and who always entertain. People who matter. Each episode, I'll speak to a person from our LGBTQIA+ rainbow, discuss their journey and their thoughts on our rich and varied queer community. One person, one life, one conversation, and I can guarantee a gay old time. My guest today is Jean-Pierre Baader, best known as one of the members of the fabulously flamboyant Swedish pop group Army of Lovers, who first splashed onto the music scene in the UK back in the early 1990s with the massive disco anthem Crucified. I remember seeing the video for the song for the first time and watching the eyeliner Jean-Pierre reclining in a bath, fanning his hairy-chested self and pretend sword fighting in not much more than a loincloth and falling in love with the sheer gay fabulous nature of what I was seeing. It was camp, it was sexual, it was beautiful and it was unapologetically queer. I became a fan in a heartbeat. That was 1991 and now more than three decades, many singles and 7 million album sales later, the band are still making music with their latest album Sexodus, and I'm one of the many worldwide fans who are so pleased to keep on dancing. Jean-Pierre, welcome to A Gay Old Time.
Thank you, Nigel. I'm honored to be here with you.
It is my absolute pleasure to have you here. As you know, like many people worldwide, I am a massive fan of Army of Lovers. So to have one of the founder members of Army of Lovers on A Gay Old Time pleases me greatly. Obviously, I want to speak lots about Army of Lovers today, but I want to go right back to the beginning, to pre-Army of Lovers, to a little Jean-Pierre Baader wandering around, going to school, being a little child. Take me back to your sort of earliest memories of otherness, of actually knowing that you were different to maybe other people around you.
I guess that would have been from a very early start, before first grade. I had a problem with other children, the guys mainly, in the where we used to live. My brothers didn't. And we were different because in those days we didn't have many foreigners living in Sweden. So we were actually the only foreign kids in the block. So they would, you know, they would say like, "Oh, you're a bloody foreigner" and stuff like that. And I would answer back that I'm not a foreigner, I'm French.
So let's explain. So you were born in France, but moved to Sweden at an early age.
Born in France. And we moved to Sweden in this like 1971, finally. Before that, we went like back and forth from 1968. And then 71, we settled down in Stockholm. And so I grew up in Stockholm, and by then I was seven, I think, or six and a half or something like that. So I got to start, when I started school, I started in Swedish school.
So how did you deal with the people sort of calling you names and things like that?
Well, I, you know, it's like the answer I gave that I was like, I was not a foreigner, I was French. It's like kind of, it didn't get to me. And they, of course, thought that I was kind of snobbish. And which didn't make things better. And my brothers used to have like friends to play with and stuff like that. I would prefer to spend a lot of time alone. And either I was playing with Legos or I was drawing a lot. And all the drawings were like lovely ladies with lovely hair and beautiful dresses. Yeah, and I could spend a lot of time alone. And I was kind of quiet. And in between, there would be some outbursts of and being very social. And I'm kind of still like that. So I would like, as a kid, I remember my grandmother would put me on the table to dance with the handkerchief, you know, like you do in the Middle Eastern dances and stuff like that. And I would do it with joy. And I wasn't shy, and then on the other hand, I really liked just to spend time by myself alone and with what was in my head for the moment.
So how was school for you? Was school an enjoyable experience, or was it a place that you dreaded to go, or was it an escape?
School was super fun. School was super fun. I love going to school. I love to, you know, get new pencils and notebooks and everything. And learning was really fun. The only thing, well, and I did well until like seventh grade. And then I started to lose interest, or I started to do other stuff. And by the eighth grade, I was not doing well at all. And then from there, I would say that I've always been like an A student from the start. And then along the way, I just, you know, drop out. And by the end, I was like, maybe you won't get a grade.
Did you have a favorite teacher at school? Were there certain subjects that you excelled at?
I liked all my teachers. I was really lucky. I had really sweet teachers from first grade and even from second grade. I was first in a Swedish school. It was a huge school they had their own dentist and a big library. And it was like a lot of kids in that school. And then second grade, I moved to the Jewish school, which was inside the city. We lived outside the city in the suburbs. So I would ride with the school bus to school. And the Jewish school was like the opposite of this big Swedish school. It was like very small. There was only one class for each year. And it was super cozy. There was no bullying. And the teachers were great. And we had an amazing headmaster, I remember. So the school experience was it was very social. Me and another friend in school, we used to spend time, you know, between the classes. We would end up talking with the teachers or with the headmaster. It was really a very nice atmosphere. It was really fun. And I did well in the Jewish school. They had two big awards. One was Best Friend Award. And in fifth grade, and I got that one. And then there was Best Athlete in school in sixth grade. So, and I won that as well. After that, I haven't been doing especially well in sports. Though I liked, you know, sport is like sex. I, watching porn is like, okay, but it's much more fun to practice than to do it. And it's the same with sport. I mean, I prefer to do sports and...
I've never thought of it like that, but that's the perfect analogy. I'm loving that. Obviously, you said there about Jewish school, because obviously your origins are French, Algerian, Jewish descent, living in Sweden at that point. So obviously there was a lot of things going on for a young Jean-Pierre to deal with. When did the subject of sexuality raise its head?
Quite early, actually. I'm one of those gays that has been gay since childhood. Of course, the awareness came with when coming into puberty. That's when the awareness comes. But so before that, there's maybe no name for the sexuality, but there is this attraction and feeling safe and feeling good being close to men, uncles and teachers and, you know, whatever. Men was cozy to be around, and I have one experience from the age of maybe five or something. And we went to a funeral, and it was, you know, at that age, you don't really understand what the funeral is. So it wasn't, for me, it wasn't a sad experience, but there was a lot of handsome men. They were all dressed in black. And I remember I was in a very good place.
So you were aware of maybe your hormones saying that you were attracted to men at an early age?
Yes, before my hormones started to do the work, actually.
To do that hormonal thing.
And then there was, as you say, I mean, growing up in Sweden with this background, you know, coming from having the Jewish and the Algerian and French background, and then coming to Sweden in the 70s, it means that there was a huge difference between home and outside home. Because outside home in Sweden in those days, there was something very popular called a free education. You know, when parents not educate children, but the behavior of children. So in Sweden, the trend was that the parents shouldn't interfere with kids. They should let them do whatever they wanted to. At home, a child had rules to follow. You got dressed by your parents, you got combed by your parents, and you got told what to do and not to do. So what do you call that? So
basically, it's like the guidelines. I don't know what the word is. It will come to me after we finish chatting. You can guarantee that. But I mean, so you were very much sort of governed. Your parents were put you on a loose rein to do what you wanted to do, basically. You were allowed to do what you wanted to do.
No, my parents did absolutely not that. I wasn't. Like, they were super strict. So for me, there was always the contrast, you know, being at home and everything was super strict. And then getting out of home and, you know, being with school friends who didn't have this education and wasn't behaving the same way. Adults would say, oh, you are those two well-behaved French boys, me and my brothers, because we used to, you know, take hand and you know, old-fashionedly, and you would never do that in Sweden.
So you were seen as very polite young boys. You mentioned that obviously you were aware of your sexuality at that point. Did you struggle with the feelings of sexuality, or were you, you know, very kind of aware and thinking, okay, well, whatever this is, it's a very pleasurable thing?
No, not at all. The late part, the first part, yes, it was complicated, because from a very early stage, I realized that the way I was feeling was not correct, was not right. I was told from an early age that I wasn't manly enough from my father. He never said that to my brothers. I felt that it was difficult. And the older I got and the sexuality awakened, the more complicated it got. And so I was, you know, when I was 14, I was living a double life. You know, one life at home and then being outside home, starting to explore. And I had a friend in school, for example, like many has the same experience. You know, we experimented together.
Yes, we all did that, didn't we?
Didn't we? Yeah.
And we loved it. Certainly did.
So there was a conflict. There was a conflict when I started to realize. And the thing is, I was, you know, with this friend, we used to talk a lot about it. And we would say, like, well, this is a natural phase, because this is what the school book said, that when you come to puberty, you're getting curious and you might want to experience with your own sex. And so we would say, like, oh, this is a phase. But I knew deep inside that this wasn't a phase for me. Instinctively, I knew that. And then when we grew up, he became bisexual. He stayed bisexual, and I came out as gay later on. And I came out not freely. It happened by accident. Actually, I came out twice. I came out once to my friends, which was before I left home. And then I at home, and that's where I ended up being kicked out of home at the age of 15 and a half. So before I came out from my family accidentally, I was in eighth grade. I was part in a TV show for with a bunch of other young people. This was a youth program, and it was five programs. And one of the programs, the theme was homosexuality in one of the programs. And so we did interviews with, in those days, a very famous drag show artist here in Sweden, and a lot of things around, you know, gayness. And we got invited to see this guy's show. So we went together with the producer and of the show, because we were too young, of course, but we had like a special invitation. So we got to go to this club. And I remember I was just like, it was like coming into Wonderland, you know, everything, all these, it was full of men, of course, and then we were invited backstage and you had these drag queens, and I was just, you know, and then for me, it was, then I realized this is what I am. This is where I should be. This is my place. And, but I knew I couldn't share this with my parents or my brothers or at home at all, because it really clashed with all my upbringing. So I started to come out to friends outside of home. I remember the first friend was one of my girlfriends that I told her. And I remember it like it was yesterday. We were standing on the schoolyard. It was in the middle of the winter. It was fucking cold. And later on, she told me, like, because she wasn't surprised. And I was telling her it was not easy. I was like trying to, I didn't know how to say it. And I just told her that I needed to tell her something. And she was just waiting and thinking, fuck, come on, it's cold. She told me later on that she was like, come on, come on. And of course, her reaction was like, okay, but you know, it wasn't a surprise. There was no evaluation about it. So it was a really nice first coming out experience. And the same with the group, the guys that we did the TV show together, of course, knew. And it was exciting. It was really exciting. So I didn't really suffer from the situation at home, because the situation outside of home was really nice and good. And I was surrounded with really good people. I had two best girlfriends that I got to know during this TV show. And both their moms were like super sweet. One of them had a makeup brand that is quite famous today, actually, Face Stockholm. I think you have it in England. It's a big brand. She started off this brand in Sweden, and I was offered to work weekends there. And so this is how I discovered, you know, makeup, and I became later on a makeup artist. And the other girl's friend, she was a really cool woman, very extravagant. She looked like an oversized Cleopatra with this black posh, and she would have green Yves Saint Laurent makeup and wearing opium. And she was very spiritual, and I would sleep over at this girlfriend's, and we would sit like half the night drinking tea and talking about, you know, everything. And they were very supportive. So what happened later on is that this girlfriend came to visit me when I was on vacation with my parents in France. We used to go every summer. We used to go like 2 days after this, we finished school, the car was packed, and 3 days later we were in Paris. And we spent the first month with my father's family in Paris, and the second one with my mother's family outside in Orléans, in the Loire region. So we were in Paris as usual in June, and she came. And she was supposed to stay like 2 weeks or something like that. And so we had an amazing first week. When she came, I didn't spend time with my parents anymore and my brothers. We would spend time going out in the city and even going out at night. My father thought she was my girlfriend. And he also thought that the other best friend was also my girlfriend. And he thought it was great that I had two girlfriends. I should just be careful to, you know, keep them apart. And we, of course, we laughed about this, and we played along, all three of us. I would, for example, sleep over at one of their places, and maybe I would sleep somewhere else. And if my parents would call and check, they would just say, you know, he's sleeping or he's in the bathroom or whatever. So I had an alibi with them. And so basically, I had this amazing week with this friend in Paris, and we did just, you know, we went to gay places, gay coffee places, we went to gay discos, and I looked older for my age, so it wasn't difficult. We managed to get into places where the age was from 18. And in one of these places, I met a guy who wanted to invite me for dinner. And I accepted, and my friend, so I was supposed to go alone on dinner, and then we were supposed to pick up my friend at where we were staying with my parents and go out together. Where we stayed in Paris, we had like two studios and a small room under the rooftop, and me and the girlfriend had the room under the rooftop, so we would have privacy. But that evening, by accident, they found out that she was alone in the room and invited her to have dinner with them. And of course, there was a lot of questions where I was, and she got nervous. And, you know, parents, they pick up things. And my father started to ask her about, you know, if we were in couple. And she, of course, she was super stressed. Afterwards, she told us it was really unpleasant. And she actually started to cry. At this time, my parents assumed that, okay, so he's probably gay. And so I came back from the dinner. The guy was, I told him, I'm going to get my friend and then we will go out dancing together. So he stayed waiting for me in a square. And I went back. And then the moment I came to the street, I saw my parents, they were standing in the window. And I could see immediately that something was like really wrong. And halfway the stairs, I meet them in the stairs, and I meet my mother, and she takes me down to the street, and we have a conversation. I don't know how long it was, but I remember that she asked me whether it was true that what they suspected, that I was, the word gay wasn't there, but homosexual. And, you know, for a moment in my head, I was like, either I can deny it and stick to my plan, which was to, you know, stay home until the age of 18, then emigrate to Israel, do my military service, and then whatever. If I would come out or not, it wasn't interesting. I would just be free from the age of 18. Or I could just tell the truth and see what would happen. And maybe I was wrong. I knew that I would not be able to stay at home. It was an impossible situation. But I took the chance. It just came out and I said, yes, that's the way it is. And of course, she started to cry. And there was talk about God and religion and, you know, all these cliches. And I don't want you to have an unhappy life. These people have such tragic lives and, you know, blah, 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 all this. And in the end, she convinced me to come back to the flat. And she said, I will deal with Dad, and you just go up to the room and we'll deal with this tomorrow. So halfway up, we meet my father in his pajamas and with eyes. My instinct was just run. So I run down the stairs and he runs after me in the pajamas. And we end up in the street shouting at each other. And in the end, I put the key to the room on the car, because I didn't want to have a contact with him. I was sure he was going to beat me or something like that, though he's never beaten me before as a kid. But his frustration was so big. And I will come back to that later on, because I actually don't have a problem with how he reacted, but more about that in a bit. So I'm alone in the middle of the night, and I'm thinking he's probably not there, the guy, anymore. I don't know how long the time span was in this discussions and all this that happened, and maybe like 45 minutes, something like that. But he was still there waiting. So we went out, and I tried to explain what happened. And he said that, of course, I could stay at his place. And we got drunk, and I had sex with him, of course, because I thought that I should, you know. And it was horrible, because my head was like, I was somewhere else. And you know, having sex was the least, the last thing on my mind, you know. But so it was a horrible night. And the day after, I called my mother, and she just said that we arranged for you and Anna, the girlfriend, to go back to Stockholm this afternoon with the train. And that was it. So, and then we were on the train in the afternoon. I came, you know, I didn't go home in between. I just came, and they had packed my suitcase and everything. And we went back to Stockholm. And I remember we were sitting, you know, when the train left the station, we were just like silent for maybe half an hour, just, you know, trying to realize what happened, you know, in the last 24 hours. And so her mother took me in as a foster child, actually. So she became my foster mom. And I was again in a great place, because I loved being with these people. They were super to me. They, you know, they really encouraged me in my gayness. I went from being, you know, a Jewish boy with glasses and well-combed to getting contact lenses, starting to wear mascara and pink clothes. And it was like, you know, the bubble burst, and out came this young person, you know, with so much to materialize, you know, to just, you know, I didn't have any limits anymore. Suddenly I could do whatever I wanted. And that was like an amazing experience. And it, at that early age, but I was lucky. I mean, it could have ended up, you know, in a different way if I didn't have all these amazing people around me.
But that's incredible. I mean, that story there is just such an amazing story. But when you went back to Stockholm and you chose not to be with your parents, not to live with your parents, was that because you couldn't, because they didn't want you to live there? Or was it just your choice to say, no, I'm moving away?
No, it wasn't my choice. I wasn't allowed to come back. My father couldn't see us two under the same roof. It wasn't my choice, but I wasn't sad about it. I mean, I was super happy. I was super happy because now I could do, you know, whatever I wanted, and I was with amazing people. The sadness came later on, many, many years later on. But at that time, there was no sadness, and there was a morning with panic because I didn't know what would happen that morning in Paris after that horrible night. But then, you know, everything, there was a solution. I got this amazing foster mother. So life was really nice in the beginning for me. And concerning my father, it didn't take me long to understand why he reacted the way he did. Because for me, it was very obvious. He came from a different culture, a different time, and he didn't know how to deal with the situation. He didn't, you know, he didn't have the tool to deal with this. And this is how he reacted. And we ended up missing out of each other, which is a really sad part. But before he died, we started to meet again. And it was really weird because we started to meet again, and we never talked about what happened. Or by then I had this career with the Army of Lovers and also being a famous hairdresser in Stockholm and everything. So, and for him to see that I was accepted outside made him probably, you know, realize that maybe this wasn't so bad. And in the end of his life, he was sorry. And we had an amazing closure. Actually, I was really happy. We found peace, and you know, he was in a very bad health situation, and I knew he didn't have a lot of time left. And I really wanted him to go. I really wanted him to understand that I didn't have anything against him. You know, I didn't hold any. And I was in therapy. You know, in therapy, when I was 37, that's when the sadness came, and you know, the feeling of, you know, not having your parents, and to have missed out on a lot of things, and trying to understand forgiveness. And that's when in therapy I realized that there was nothing to forgive, because he didn't do anything wrong on purpose. It wasn't meant to harm me. That wasn't the point. He just couldn't deal with it. And of course it was painful, but it was painful for him as well. And for me.
It's lovely that you got that closure in the end, though, because that's such a traumatic thing to go through. So at that point in your life, Jean-Pierre, when you were living with your foster mother and you'd found your new family, if you like, what age were you and what kind of stage of your career were you at? Had you started working for the makeup at that point?
So I was 16 and I was still in school, in high school, and I started to work as an extra job on weekends with selling makeup. And also, you know, when selling makeup, giving advices and stuff like that. So my friend's mom saw that, and she actually booked me for my first makeup job for a small fashion show. And, you know, I was in school. You couldn't go like an education for makeup. You would go assistant for another makeup artist. And in those days in Stockholm, we had like three makeup artists, and that was it. So after a while, I started to be an apprentice to one of these makeup artists. So things were really good. But school was suffering. So in the end, when I finished high school, I was almost not getting grades in some of the topics.
I think there's often a sort of common thread within the queer community that when we do come out to our parents, and if we have maybe like a bad reaction or whatever, it's not that we rebel, but we kind of like immediately try and immerse ourselves in as much gayness as possible with clubbing and nights out and, you know, decadence here and there. Was that something that you threw yourself into? Were you a clubber? Were you, you know, very much a party animal at that point as well?
Yes, I started to go out to clubs very early. I mean, when the first experience I had with this group of people for the TV show, that was a whole new world opening, and I became a regular at this club. with mixed feelings, because dating or the flirting part was complicated. And I think it was because I, deep inside, I still had this guilt. You know, I had the, for a long time, I had guilt having sex. There was like a part of me that was like, I'm doing something that I'm not supposed to do. And it was a mixed feeling, a guilt, but also pleasure. So it's like a very mixed feeling. And I think that's also something common for us when we come out, that we still have this guilt, carrying this guilt with us.
Absolutely. I could not agree more. It's one of those things. I know, because my mum's reaction to my sexuality was not particularly good. So you do carry that shame and that sense of disappointment and that sense of, I shouldn't be doing this, even though, as you say, the you know, the art of being gay, the sex is very pleasurable. When did you start to feel fully comfortable in your own skin?
I wasn't, as many teenagers, I wasn't really comfortable in my body then, but it wasn't about being the gay thing. It was just, you know, a youth thing. And with time, I've become more and more comfortable in my body. This is also a phase. I've been speaking with other gay people, even younger than me, having a phase of thinking, maybe I'm in the wrong sex. So not long ago, I realized that I wasn't in the wrong sex, but to find out, just to have the thought. And I realized why. And that is because we didn't have any role models. And for example, I love to watch black and white movies. When I was a kid, that was the only thing on TV. And of course, the only one that you could identify yourself with was the heroine, the woman that fell in love with the handsome man. This was the one that you could identify yourself with. And you do it so much and so many times for so many years, at the end, you think you're a girl. And I realized it because I was watching this new series on Sky Showtime, Fellow Travelers. And I've seen it since then. Of course, there's been a lot of amazing gay shows, and even for kids like Heartstopper, for example. And we didn't have this. I realized how important it is to have in movies or in media to have role models. And suddenly, it made sense to me that it's totally okay that you have the Little Mermaid made with a girl that is not white. Because it works in the story, actually. I mean, there's no problem with it. And I know a lot of people had a problem with it. And it's kind of woke to say that you need to have representation, but there is woke and woke. This is actually something that is more basic, it is better for us if we grow up with something that we can identify with, and regardless of color and gender and sexual preferences and everything.
It seems like you were at a point in your life with your career beginning and your sexuality, you know, those that needed to know knew about it, or, you know, that you chose to tell. When I speak to some people on the podcast, there is often a clash between their career and their sexuality, maybe having to hide their sexuality because of their career. But it seems with you, Jean-Pierre, I mean, you know, hairdresser, makeup artist, and then obviously when the music came along, which we must talk about, of course, that there was no clash, that actually it was a very beautiful home for your sexuality.
Yes. And I was just, as I said before, I was encouraged. I mean, if I would have stayed home, I would never have had the possibility to become a makeup artist. They would never have agreed with that. I remember I wanted to dance, and that was like a total no-no. Men didn't dance. So then you understand why I was so happy to get out of that, because there were so many things I wanted to do and I like to do that I couldn't do, and suddenly I could do it. And I even made it my profession. And the same with music. I mean, Army of Lovers was in the beginning very much still a part of this rebellion to in public become what was the most dreaded in my home. But in the end, you know, he actually was proud of me. I met a person in Tel Aviv, and this is such a beautiful story. She said, like, you know, I met your father once in Paris. Oh, I said, oh, that's nice. And she said, like, yeah, and he asked if maybe I knew you, because he said, like, I have a son, and he's a little bit famous. And she said, she said, of course I know who he is. And he was really proud, and that was so sweet. So even though he didn't tell me, in my face, I know that that he was proud of me and that there was love. And this is why also it was just a confirmation of everything that I thought about, you know, his disability to handle the situation.
That is beautiful. So when Army of Lovers came along, tell me about that first meeting with Alexander, because it was you two initially that kind of sort of germinated the seed of Army of Lovers, wasn't it?
So the thing with Alexander started for me when I was in Kos with a drag show group. And in the middle of the summer, we had a new girl joining the show that told us that in Stockholm there was this, because you didn't have internet in those days. So being in Kos, you didn't know what happened in Stockholm unless, you know, you got a Swedish, somebody bringing you a Swedish magazine or something. And so he told us about this new phenomena in Stockholm, this drag queen that was like not a traditional drag queen because it was really ugly and weird. And it is this song called Prostitution Twist. And it was like, but it was so cool because he's not like the regular drag thing. It was like really new. And we all were like, wow, that sounds like really fun and cool. And coming back to Stockholm, I was introduced to him by a person that I've been working with as a makeup artist, Camilla Thien, that is our costume maker. She was doing his costumes for stage, and she knew me, and she proposed me as a makeup artist. But since I was doing, she knew I was doing the drag shows, and she said, "But he can also be on stage. So if you need a backup dancer or a backup singer or whatever, you could use him as that as well." So he came to see back in Stockholm. I joined another group, drag show group, and we were doing a show. And he came to see the show, and we were introduced, and that was the beginning of a beautiful friendship. And the drag show group that I did, I think we connected because it wasn't one of those drag show groups where we all try to look beautiful. We wanted to look beautiful, but it was for example, I was only wearing blonde wigs, all the time blonde wigs and open cleavage. So you would see my hairy chest. So it was like kind of queer, very queer drag show. And the star of the show was Britta Bratwurst. And she was like super ugly with like false teeth that were ugly. She had a wig with like very little hair, super ugly makeup. And she was the diva of the show. And people thought it was hilarious. So it was a kind of anti-gay thing. So I think that also, you know, for Alexander, that I wasn't just a drag queen. And you could probably see there was like the drag scene as a vehicle.
So Army of Lovers, I mean, I know when you and Alexander first got together, you were in a band called Barbie, that's correct. And then did Barbie evolve into Army of Lovers?
Yes, slowly, slowly. We started to, and then Camilla came in because he wanted to have like two backup dancers, and he thought that he had me, so we should have like maybe a girl. And once again, Camilla Thien suggested one girl that had been a model to her, and it was Camilla, who became like Camilla later on in Army of Lovers. So we were all three of us, and we had a lot of fun. And we went to a lot of parties, and in those days, you know, Swedish media was never understood the Barbie thing. It was similar to something like Divine. It was like very punkish and edgy. And here in Sweden was like, we had a very famous drag show star who was nominated to be Swedish most beautiful woman twice because he was so beautiful. So they didn't get this, the drag thing not being beautiful. It was like, what's the point?
Barbie they didn't get, but then Army of Lovers, you were performing, you had La Camilla come in. So it was the three of you together.
And they still didn't get it. So they didn't get Barbie, but we became good friends, and we started to, you know, we had ideas what we wanted to, things that we would like to do, and Alexander realized after a while, like, hey, we should make a band together. And so because he got tired of Barbie, when he gets tired of something, he just drops it and he moves on. So we became Army of Lovers. And funny enough, so the first single, When the Night is Cold, we thought, because Barbie was like totally crazy. In Barbie was the first time I wore this, the penis, the long thing. what would you call that in English?
Like a penis dildo attached to a codpiece kind of thing, isn't it?
Yes, and it's inspired actually by indigenous people somewhere in the world. They use it and they actually use it like to carry money or something like that. I don't know, but this is where the inspiration comes from. So there is actually people having these long penis things.
So this was part of the Army of Lovers look at that point?
Before, that was pre-Army of Lovers. So when we did the first single, we decided to tone down everything. Because what happened in the end of Barbie, like I think Barbie's last song, which was Around the World, which we did as we covered as Army of Lovers with Villa Camila as lead vocals. People loved the song. When they heard it was Barbie, they went like, no way, no. And they couldn't like the song. So we thought that maybe we should tone down so people would hear the music and hear us. So the first single, I was in black leather pants and it's kind of a flamenco shirt, but not very flamboyant, quite, you know. If you see the cover of the single When the Night's Cold, you understand. And like Camila, you know, she's dressed in a pretty dress, and we kind of look normal. But that was so boring. So I mean, after that, we started to, you know, we couldn't hide our true colors. And then the more we've been doing it, the more we just, you know, been letting go and no censorship and just, you know, go for it.
Let's go back to 1991, Crucified, which I know wasn't your first single, but it was obviously the single that I think certainly brought you to the forefront here in the UK and then pretty much around the world, because it was a massive smash, one of the biggest Euro hits that year. I remember seeing the video for Army of Lovers Crucified for the first time and seeing your fabulous self fanning yourself and wearing the makeup and the long hair and the hairy chest and wearing this kind of like little loincloth and just thinking, oh my gosh, this is a party that I want to go to. And I think I was not alone. There were, you know, thousands upon thousands upon thousands upon millions of people worldwide who probably thought the same. Were you surprised at the joyous reaction to that song and also to the video? Because that video is still iconic till this day.
I don't know. I don't think I even reflected in, you know, whether people would like it or not, because at that point we were just doing our thing and we were used to that people didn't really get it. We had a smaller hit with Ride the Bullet on MTV, which made us feel, you know, hunger for more. And, we, you know, doing the videos was like, wow, it's not only the music, we also have the videos to work with as well. So the full package. So the videos became very important for us. So when we did the Crucified video, we really had a lot of fun. It was like, it was really great to shoot this mini movie, to be on a mini movie set. So the whole surrounding thing was amazing. And then being able to go for these, for us, it was obvious. We wouldn't do anything with crosses or anything with religion because of the title. So we chose to go in a totally different direction, a different kind of being crucified. And we just went for it. Fun fact, I was super sick during the shooting. I had, like, in the bathtub scene, I had like high fever. And I was supposed to have this little thing, but I ended up to have all the belts around my stomach because I was so bloated. But still, I had so much fun.
And you still looked super, super sexy with it as well, let me tell you. Was it very important for you as a band? I mean, I know there's been many incarnations of Army of Lovers over the years. Members have come and gone. I mean, you have been there constantly. Obviously, Alexander has said that he is bisexual. You are an openly gay man. I think any member of the band is always presented in a very sexual way, not sexualized, but sexual, very sort of sexually confident. Was it very important for you guys to actually sort of represent your community, represent your sexuality with every video, with every outfit, with every piece of imagery?
I think sexuality was important for all of us for different reasons. For me, it was still the rebellion part and also dealing with the shame part and, you know, trying to overcome it by embracing it fully. I never thought about the community thing. In those days, actually, the community in those days would say they actually didn't like me because I would get things like, you're just confirming all the prejudice that people have about gay people. And I would say like, but sorry, I can't do your work. I'm not a jeans and t-shirt guy. This is what I am, and I can just promote this. I can't promote your stuff. You have to promote that yourself. And later on, of course, the community grew, and we had more people showing themselves, because of course you always see the show people, but people needed to see the rest of us, because we are a community that is with many faces and with many levels. And luckily today it shows.
Were you aware all the way through the Army of Lovers career of your popularity, particularly with a queer audience, with an LGBTQ plus audience?
Not really, because the community was in Sweden. The community was still, you know, a little bit in the closet. It wasn't until the mid 90s that it started to move, early 90s, but it wasn't like in the end of the 90s that the community was almost where it is today. Like, so for me, it was mainly, I mean, I had mostly girls liking me. And I remember I was like kind of disappointed, because I wanted the guys to like me, of course. But then again, straight guys and bisexual guys really liked me.
If you'd come to the UK, Jean-Pierre, I think every gay person that I knew at that point, all of my gay friends were loving Army of Lovers. And especially, I mean, I want to say you as well, because your image, I mean, was just so beautifully flamboyant, creative, sexual, queer, call it what you will. But it was just so very you. You could see, I think, as a person looking in, that you were living your true life and being your true self.
And, you know, that is really important, because it is important to feel that you are loved by your own people, your family or your tribe or your community. And I didn't feel that in the beginning with the community here, but I wanted to. So, and today, for me, this is the most important part of Army of Lovers for me. It's the gay community, and to have this, to belong to it, and to be part of a long line of. I mean, we're not the first. We have other fighters, or whatever you would call them, that has been. So I'm just passing around. I was joking a couple of years ago when you had Conchita Wurst winning the Eurovision, and people would say, like, oh, you're so alike. I would say, no, I'm his grandmother. this is my way of having kids. You know, I think this is how we have kids. We pass on to the next generation, and that's our legacy and our, you know, kids, and they will do the same later on as well.
You mentioned Eurovision there, so I have to throw in, obviously, Army of Lovers came back, you know, a few years ago now to try and represent Sweden at Eurovision. I mean, Sweden is pretty much the home of Eurovision. I mean, you guys do it so incredibly well. I know you didn't make it through Melodi Festival, and sadly, with Rocking the Ride, but that must have been a real moment for you to actually go back into, or not to go back into Eurovision, to be part of Eurovision, because I imagine it's something that's been very close to your heart, maybe as a viewer for many years.
It certainly was. You know, growing up in Sweden, and I think the same for the rest of Europe, you didn't have all these channels that we have today. In Sweden, we had two channels, and the Swedish broadcasting company was very much lefties. So the programs were, you know, we didn't have very glamorous programs. There was a lot of, like, heavy documentaries. Late night, they would show black and white movies. And that was, you know, that was amazing. That was the only thing that happened. It was like night. And then you had Eurovision. So once a year, you had this fabulous, great show that was nothing like Swedish television. It was like, it was Christmas Eve, New Year's Eve, you know? It was amazing. So, yes, growing up, I remember, I think my first awareness with Eurovision is the year before ABBA, 1973, or even 1972, maybe, because I remember there was an Israeli song that I still like as a grown-up. So, yes, so growing up, I actually did makeup and hair for a lot of Eurovision artists in the late 80s, because with Barbie, I got connected to his record label and a lot of the artists in that record label, and ended up doing, you know, makeup for their videos and performances in the Melodi Festival, the Mello, as it's called, because you have Eurovision, which is the the big one, and then you have Mello, which is the Melodifestival in the Swedish version, and it has a life of its own. It's a holy day in Sweden, more or less, not only for gay people, but like the whole of Sweden just stops watching this. And you know, what started with the one night show ended up like it is now. We don't have one show. We have like for 4 weeks, we have every weekend a new finale, and then it ends up with a big finale. So they've extended it. It's like even bigger than it was before. We've had like the year after ABBA won, Sweden boycotted the Eurovision because it was, you know, you don't have a competition about something that like music. You can't compete in music, and the Eurovision Schlager music, this is not real music and stuff like that. So they actually decided not to do. This was the left influence on Swedish television that, you know, got it banned for only 1 year. The year after was back again.
So how was your experience of Eurovision? Because obviously you and Alexander back with La Camilla for Rocking the Ride. I imagine it was a very enjoyable experience.
It was a great experience. It was so much fun. The crew and the whole organization around this, they are so sweet. They really make sure that you have a good time. Usually I have stage fright. I didn't have it this time. I had so much fun. It was such a happy and fun and exciting. It was like a small adventure. I had a really good time. And with everything, you know, rehearsing and, you know, making the costumes. I had an idea that I wanted to, you know, from the gold penis thing, which was being like Bacchus or something, I wanted to become a fawn. So, you know, still not human, not a man, not a woman, not even a human, but something in between. And it was really fun. So I got this little costume with the tail and fur, furry legs and everything. So the whole thing was like really, really fun.
I do think Army of Lovers should be part of Eurovision next time it's back in Sweden, which we all know is very, very soon. You know, you as a hairdresser, you as a makeup artist, you know, the clothing as well. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but when I looked at Army of Lovers, I always used to think, I bet Jean-Pierre is behind a lot of those outfits because you wore them incredibly well. Quite often you were wearing less clothing than there actually was flesh. But I love the fact that you always looked incredibly fashionable. So were you behind the costumes?
We have a costume designer, Camilla Thulin. So she is the one behind the costumes, but she, you know, she works with us. So she has a vision. We come with, you know, we present songs, the new songs to her. She comes back with the vision of it, and then it's tailor-made for each one of us. And with the years, we've become more and more, you know, she knows what I'm comfortable with. She knows what Alexander is comfortable with. And we all know that we, you know, it's not that she says like, this is my vision, and she throws it on us. It's a collaboration, like we do with the whole team, with the video team and with the composers. It's like a collaboration. Everybody has their field, but we are, you know, we are working together in it. So for me, I would have ideas that I would, and my ideas would go very well with her ideas. So she would absolutely support, and we would just, you know, have a lot of fun, because I would like to be like a Bacchus figure. And she would say like, yeah, and then you should have hoofs and you know, and then we would end up with a fabulous costume.
So it would be very collaborative between you and her. Is that the same now with the new era of Army of Lovers? Because obviously you are back now, yourself, Alexander, Dominika are back with the fabulous album Sexodus. So for the new Army of Lovers, if you like, is it still very much a collaborative effort when it comes to the look?
Yes, it is. And so just as the music, the look is about, so we have a couple of new outfits, but then we've actually brought back some of the old outfits that we felt maybe didn't get, you know, the proper exposure. So it's like the music. Some parts are revisited. And so this is the fun part with the costume now, that we've used some of the old costumes in new combination, and then we have totally new stuff as well.
What made you come back?
And I have a new wig.
Of course. What made you come back? Because so many of us obviously are so pleased to see you back.
So actually, just before the pandemic, we had the 30-year jubilee of Crucified coming up for 21. Anders Wahlbeck had an idea for a song that he passed to us, and we liked it. And Alexander and Dominika came down to visit me in Tel Aviv, because I was living in Tel Aviv in those days. But it was like I was with a broken hip, heavily medicated. And 2 weeks later, we had COVID, the world closing down for COVID. So what we started, we just forgot about it. And we didn't think more about it until Alia Polyakova contacted us via one of our composers, because she's been working with him. And when she got to know that he worked with us, she was like, I'm their biggest fan. I would love to do something with them. And so we started to, you know, maybe we should do something together. And she wanted to have something that was different and not the usual, because she got a lot of things about, you know, freedom and peace and blah, blah, blah. And she didn't want that. She wanted to have something different. So we came up with Love is Blue. And funny enough, blue is like, in Russian, it's like, or Ukrainian, it's like a nickname for gay, like blue love. It's homosexual love. So, yeah. So she actually ignited everything. So we did the song, and while doing the song, we had so much fun writing the lyrics, recording, and we just decided to go back to the drawing of what we did, you know, what we started with. We had a beginning of Sexodus, and we decided, let's have a go at it. And because it was such a fun to do Love is Blue. And then we just, you know, and Anders Wahlbeck got inspired. Anders Hansson, the other composer who did Love is Blue, he also got inspired. And, you know, and then things started to happen, and we had a lot of fun doing it. It wasn't planned. It wasn't planned to be a comeback, but it ended up being one.
We are so pleased about that. And I've got to say, with Alia Polyakova as well, I love the fact that obviously she is a Ukrainian singer. And I think if anybody Googles her after the podcast today, they will see that she is very, very much an ally. She loves to champion LGBTQ+ rights.
Yes. And she, you know, we celebrated her birthday together last year. And she said, like, she grew up with the Army of Lovers videos, and that was a huge inspiration for her. And you can almost see that on her way of performing, that she's, you know, she's inspired. And as you say, she's like a big supporter of the community. And she's fabulous. She's this tall, blonde goddess. With a fabulous
voice. Absolutely. The perfect extra member to Army of Lovers.
Oh, yes. Yes, yeah, totally. And we performed once with her here in Stockholm. So we did choreography, and we knew that she wouldn't have the time to come in for rehearsals. Or the only time would be the day we were going to do the show. But we knew that, we said, like, hey, she's a super pro. She would, you know, she would get it immediately. And so the choreography that we had planned worked. And just as we said, she just owned it. She was fabulous. I think you can see it. You can see the clip on YouTube.
I've watched it many a time, let me tell you.
And isn't it funny how, because the choreography is really simple, it's nothing complicated. We're kind of moving back and forth, like in the Supremes kind of way, you know, very easy, because we wanted it to be easy for Alia as well. But the thing is, so Dominika was the one giving, because she was in the middle, giving the pace. But in the rehearsals, she wasn't wearing a long skirt. In the show, she has a long skirt, and you don't see her legs. So there's nothing to go after. So I ended up following, Ali and me ended up, you know, doing together. Dominika went in one direction, and Alexander in another direction. It's like total mayhem with something that would have been so easy. But, you know, just the fact that we didn't see them, her legs just... But it's kind of, it's us. We do, the choreographies we do are very homemade and are supposed to. We've had many offers from famous choreographers here in Sweden saying, like, I would love to choreograph you. And we would say, like, yes, that would be really sweet, but we'd rather do it ourselves. It's meant to be like kids in the living rooms, you know. Like in the beginning, we performed with brushes and with toilet brushes and everything, except real microphones, like you do when you're a kid in front of the mirror, you know, miming to ABBA.
So true. It's an inspiration to us all. Let's have a little bit of fun, Jean-Pierre, something I like to do here on A Gay Old Time. You are having a dinner date, a dinner party, and you can invite any guests that you like, LGBTQ or otherwise. 5 perfect dinner guests. Who would you pick and why?
Oh, wow. This is so, so hard. This is not the first time I get this kind of question. And it's always just as difficult because there's so many to pick from. And it depends what kind of dinner you want. Do you want to have like a chatty girls' dinner? In that case, there would be Cher, of course, Madonna, of course, Grace Jones, of course. That would be, you know, so fun to have those three together. And I know Grace Jones isn't very fond of Madonna. So that would be, you know, that would be like a really, I think, kind of a bitch dinner, but with heart. So that would be one kind of dinner. Another kind of dinner would be, do they have to be alive?
No, not at all. This is pure fantasy.
Okay, so then I would love to have a dinner with Oscar Wilde and Leonardo da Vinci and also Caravaggio. So it's not five. So, but I mean, that would be a very interesting dinner with those three. I mean, one that is very verbal, and these other amazing, amazing painters, and all of them being gay, of course, and from different centuries. That would be like really interesting conversations. And maybe we would end up having sex, all of us together.
Wow. If put me down for the meal, if there's a space at the table with Grace Jones, Cher and Madonna, I am so down for that one.
Oh, there's always a place
I'll
for
be there.
You.
Thank you very much, Jean-Pierre.
There's always room for one
Bless
more.
Bless you.
Especially if it's you.
You're too kind. What's the best experience that you've ever had in an LGBTQ plus club?
Oh, wow. That would be, of course, that first experience when we met, we saw that this the drag queen. I mean, the moment I remember we're knocking on the door to the backstage area where they were doing makeup and everything. And one of the girls opened and with this amazing makeup. And it was such a moment. It was like the door, he opened the door to heaven, to paradise or something. Because you could sneak in and see, you know, you could see them starting to get dressed in their under things, and everything was like, wow. And then the music, of course. So that first night, that was my first night out in a gay place, and I will always remember it. And the show was amazing. I think that's the moment I felt, yes, I want to do that too. I want to do a drag show as well.
So you'd found queer nirvana. What is the song that is guaranteed to get you on the dance floor?
Queer nirvana, that's good. I would say anything, I mean, if like anything with rhythm, like oriental rhythm, like Middle Eastern music, that always puts me in a good dancing mood. And then, of course, Balearic house, that would also work for me. When the Italo house came, wow. I mean, in the 90s, I spent so much time in the clubs in between. I used to be a regular in one of the biggest clubs in Stockholm. And when we became famous, I didn't stop going. And it was really nice because since I was a regular already, it wasn't weird that I was there and, you know, being famous and they were playing Crucified, you know, on the dance floor and I would be dancing. It was really fun.
Rightly so. You've got to dance to Crucified.
It's difficult to pick just one. It depends, you know, on the mood. I mean, if you want to sing along, of course, it's ABBA. Anything from ABBA. If you want to dance and sing along, ABBA for sure. Also some Swedish, the Eurovision, the Swedish Schlager music, like some of the Alcazar songs. They're really great. They really want make you want to dance. And there's a couple of them not known outside of Sweden that are really, really good.
Lovely stuff.
Anything that has like beat and a bit of drama and something like that, yeah.
I want to go to your disco straight away. Have you ever done the gay holiday?
Yes.
Where was it?
I almost lived the gay holiday because in 2006, I bought a small studio with a friend in Barcelona. I celebrated my 40 years birthday in Barcelona. I've never been there before. And so I had it on my bucket list and I thought, that's what I'm going to do for my 40s. I will go with my best friend. So me and my best friend booked tickets and we rented a small flat. And we ended up being 12 friends joining us. So we ended up renting a big flat and a couple of us traveled together and we had so much fun. I was like, amazing, amazing weekend. And I fell in love with Barcelona, of course. So not long after, we bought this small studio and we used to go like twice a month, maybe because it was so cheap to travel from Stockholm to Barcelona and do the gay weekend with the clubs because Barcelona is the mother of Ibiza. And so the clubs in Barcelona are the mothers of the clubs on Ibiza. And of course, I've done Ibiza many times with gay friends, you know, renting house, pool, and having, you know, one day at home, one day clubbing, one day home, one day clubbing.
I love your life, literally.
I've been spoiled. I've been having a lot of fun with amazing, amazing people around me.
What's your proudest rainbow-flavoured moment? If there's one moment in your life that you just think, yep, that was my queer moment in the spotlight, what would it be?
I have actually three of them.
Yeah, of course it is. You're allowed to have as many as you like, Jean-Pierre.
Because I have many. So I would pick my three most important and favorite ones. The first one would be 92 doing the spring fashion show for Jean-Paul Gaultier. That was amazing. And it was so cliché, you know, to be on the stage and then you see all the celebrities like Catherine Deneuve and international celebrities. And D-Light was in the audience. And it was such fun to be, you know, like, oh, you're down there and we are up here. it was really fun. And I was a huge fan of Gaultier. So it was the experience of, you know, the fittings and everything. It was wow. It was wow. The second one is the opening of MTV Russia together with Pet Shop Boys in Moscow. That was really amazing. And unfortunately, I got to see them on a distance, but we didn't get to talk or anything, because in those, when you have those situations, you know, everybody's apart somewhere and you cross each other in the hallway, more or less. But that was an amazing experience. And to be in Russia was like super exotic, because this was the first time they opened up with Perestroika and Gorbachev and everything. And It was Russia in the making, you know, from the Soviet Union. And the third one is our performance in Tel Aviv for the Gay Pride with a huge audience. And we wanted to perform there. I mean, since Israelism, we wanted to perform in Israel. But the record company would, you know, they wouldn't. Record companies is all about money. They would say, like, you don't sell records there. Okay, yes, you're on the top 10, you're on the top 10 list, but they don't buy records in those countries. It was the same with Turkey. We wanted to go there as well. No, there's no money. You don't do money going there. So very cynical. But for us, it was like, we want to go. And so finally, 2017, we got to perform at the Gay Pride after the big parade that is along the beach. And that was amazing. That was amazing. And I was like in the clouds, because in the end of our show, we did three songs. And in the end of the show, I got to say, like, besides, like, thank you, we love you. And so, like, tomorrow, these two guys are going back, but I'm staying. And I was like, so it was double. It was like performing and also being in a place where I really wanted to be. Because being there was like, as I told you, when growing up, my plan was to, you know, to move to Israel at the age of 18 and to become Israeli and everything. And that didn't happen. So when I turned 50, I was, you know, like many of us do when we turn half a century, it's like, okay, is this the life I want to live? Am I happy with what I'm having? Is this going in the right direction? And everything was like, no, no, no. And so I just decided to go back to my original plan because being in Barcelona, I met a lot of people from Lebanon and from Israel, mostly Beirut and Tel Aviv. And I've seen so many amazing scenes where you would see like three guys making out and you would see two of them having Hebrew tattoos and the other one having Arabic tattoos. And I was like, wow, the Middle East and Tel Aviv. I've totally disconnected myself from everything Jewish when I moved from home. So for me, it was like reconnecting with all of that, with my family, with my gayness as well, because Tel Aviv is the gay capital of the, I mean, it's amazing. It's the first time I've been somewhere not feeling as a minority. Because you don't have like one gay club that is moving around and one gay bar, and you don't need it more, because the whole of the city is so gay. You really feel that I could meet someone in the supermarket or in the bar, or there is no, you know, the borders between gay and straight are basically not existing in Tel Aviv.
Three beautiful moments that you should be very, very proud of. Jean-Pierre Barda from the Army of Lovers, can I say thank you so much for joining us today? It's been an absolute pleasure. People need to like check out the entire back catalogue if they don't know it already. And of course, check out the latest album, Sextus, as well. But thank you for joining me today and proving that indeed your life has been a gay old time.
It surely has. And thank you. And thank you to your sweet listeners. It's really a privilege and an honor to be guest in your show. It's lovely. Thank you so much.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you. That's it for this episode of A Gay Old Time. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Jean-Pierre as much as I did. I adored speaking to him, and I can pretty much guarantee the first thing that I'm doing after this podcast is listening pretty much to the entire back catalogue of the Army of Lovers. I suggest you do the same. If you'd like to experience more rainbow joy, then please subscribe and follow the podcast on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you're listening right now, maybe on the Gaydio app, and do share it to anyone else you think would love to listen in. If you'd like to follow the podcast online, then head to the Instagram account at A Gay Old Time Podcast. And you can also find out more at www.nigelmay.net. Thanks a million to Juliet at Pineapple Audio Production for making everything so sparkly and gorgeous as ever. I'll be back soon with another episode featuring a deep and meaningful with an inspirational individual. Until then, from me, Nigel May, sending all the love and hoping that whatever you're up to, if it applies to you, that you're having a gay old time. Enjoy!